The martyred Protestant wife is a familiar figure in the social history of the West. These ladies thought they were being self-effacing when actually they were boiling beneath the surface. A surprising example of this was the wife of Bronson Alcott, the woman who was the original of the seraphic marmy of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, once burst out, "A woman lives neglected and dies forgotten, but a man who never performs in his whole life one self-denying act, but who has accidental gifts of genius, is celebrated by his contemporaries, while his name and his works live on from age to age." Sarah Edwards stopped straining to please God and began to live in the assurance of a salvation she didn't have to try to deserve. She stopped pushing herself to be worthy of Edwards's love, and from then on had his unreserved admiration. Before, onlookers had considered her a saint, but her husband knew she wasn't. Afterward, Edwards marveled at her constant sweet peace, calm, and serenity of soul. William James, when he was puzzling about whether sainthood was a form of insanity, finally concluded, "By their fruits ye shall know them. The good disposition which a vision, a voice, or other apparent heavenly favor leave behind them are the only marks by which we may be sure they are not possible deceptions." For the rest of their life together, Edwards was to marvel at his wife's good disposition. As he put it, she lived with a daily sensible doing and suffering everything for God, eating for God, and working for God, and sleeping for God, and bearing pain and trouble for God, and doing all as the service of love, and so doing it with a continual, uninterrupted cheerfulness, peace, and joy. He was also struck by her continual rejoicing in all the works of God's hands, the works of nature and God's daily works of providence, and her wonderful access to God by prayer. Her husband makes plain that Sarah's new sanctified state did not make her neglect the everyday matters of actual living. As a matter of fact, it made her more efficient, for worldly business has been attended with great alacrity as part of the service of God. She has found to be as good as prayer. Edwards added that not only has she resumed her relative and social duties, but showed a noted eminence in them. On March 27, 1742, at 6:45 a.m., an earthquake made a very loud noise in New England, jouncing plates and scaring babies. The physical rocking of the world matched the shaking up of Sarah Edwards. As William James was baffled in 1902, so we still cannot be sure whether she had a religious transport or a nervous breakdown, or whether the two were mingled. But the evidence is clear that after whatever it was, Sarah picked up life again and went on as before, but in a new dimension of joy. Her own words may explain it. She said it left her with the riches of full assurance. She recalled how midway in that peculiar week she woke and was led to reflect on God's mercy to me in giving me for many years a willingness to die, and after that, in making me willing to live. The neurotic martyr is ready to die. The greater valor is to be willing to live. Her husband explained. Now, if such things are enthusiasm and the offspring of a distempered brain, let my brain be possessed evermore of that happy distemper. If this be distraction, I pray God that the world of mankind may all be seized with this glorious distraction. And Sarah said to him, I could sit and sing this life away. Chapter 9, Rumblings. Mr. Edwards replied, he must not run away. Sarah Edwards. Sarah's disturbance in the year 1742 is reflected in her one hiatus in a cycle of producing a baby every 2 years. There was a conspicuous pause. Then on May 8, 1743, at midnight, a daughter named Eunice arrived. Because of the new baby, Sarah was unable to accompany Edwards to clergy meetings that year, so he took along their daughter Sarah, who was then ripening into a poised young teenager. In September, when he went down to the Yale commencement, it was their daughter Mary's turn to ride along with her father. In New Haven, the two Edwardses met a young man named David Brainerd, who was to provide the family with a later complication. The subsequent 3 years were uneventful, punctuated by the arrival of Jonathan Jr. on May 26, 1745, a Sunday. The family life turned on a quiet rhythm of worship and domesticity, planting the garden, picking the apples, studying, preparing for Sunday. It was a time of ripening, of consolidating spiritual gains, and they were to need the armor of it later. A peripheral cloud for Sarah was concerned that her family back in New Haven had caught the hostility against the awakening. After Whitfield had visited Northampton, he had gone down to New Haven. Though the colonial legislature adjourned to hear him, the university snubbed him, taking its clue from President Clapp. Sarah's brother, James Pierpont, chose to be allied with Whitfield. James had prospered as a druggist in Boston and then returned to live in the family house and be a leisured gentleman. His hobby was genealogy, and he kept happily occupied trying to prove he was heir to the British Duke of Kingston. This would have related him to Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, the Duke's daughter and a diplomat's wife, who was herself famous as a writer of scintillating letters. This relationship was still to be debated in the press in 1876 when Edwards Pierpont, American ambassador to the court of St. James's, claimed to have ducal ancestors. James never foresaw that ducal wealth would come into the family line through another source. One of his descendants was to be J.P. Morgan. When Whitfield turned up again in New Haven in 1746, the local clergy association advised a First Church not to allow him to preach. At that, James Pierpont constructed at his own expense a platform on New Haven Green, where a vast assembly heard Whitfield deliver one of his most celebrated speeches. It was a conversation with Father Abraham in which Whitfield would bellow to the sky, "Have you any Congregationalists up there? Any Presbyterians? Any Baptists?" After a pause to allow suspense to generate, Whitfield would report that Father Abraham had told him, "We know none of these names up here." This was a pioneering ecumenical pronouncement, but it did not please denominationalists of the day. The speech caused a split in First Church, and James F. Pierpont contributed enthusiastically to a new blue meeting house, a name referring to its color, which was built in 1748 by the people who were adherents of Whitfield. James paid for the episode by diminished popularity in town, though he kept on as a select man until 1773. These events also were the reason for a split in New Haven church life that lasted for centuries. Back in Northampton, as the children grew, the girls became conspicuously prettier, and the numbers of young preachers trooping to visit the famous theologian increased, and the old nuisance about money also grew. Sarah almost every night had an extra plate or two to fill at her long dinner table, and small feet had a way of outgrowing shoes. there has turned up in a Scottish bookstore where it had been slipped into an early Edwards memoir, a receipt in Edwards' own handwriting that indicates how pressed the family was for money as far back as 1742. In those days, the town constables were supposed to pay the preacher's wages out of taxes. Sometimes a constable was lax about collecting taxes, and the minister had to wait to be paid. The receipt shows that Edwards had once bypassed the constable and simply taken from a lenient neighbor the portion of his taxes that would have been marked for Edwards' salary. The note says, "To preserved Bartlett Constable, this note returned by you to me shall be accepted as £1.06 of my salary received of Sam Phelps and me." It was dated Northampton, May 31, 1742. In 1744, the family was still pinched, and it was Sarah's turn to try to extract their delayed salary from a constable. Preserved in Northampton still is a hasty scrawl with spelling so bad that it indicates her haste and agitation. "Sir, Mr. Sheldon just now informs me that you cannot send all the money at the time. Mr. Edwards is rid out, and therefore I write to desire you to send some as much as you possibly can." They had another pressure on them in this period. Fellow clerics began openly to show their antagonism to Edwards. When he was taking his young daughter Sarah with him to Boston in 1743, they met at the switching station in Brookfield, Massachusetts. Edwards's old opponent, President Thomas Clapp of Yale. Cooped up together in a coach all the way to Boston, the men earnestly disputed. Afterward, Clapp reported that Edwards and Whitfield had a scheme to oust some New England clergy and replace them with men from Scotland. Edwards insisted that Clapp had picked up some strange and wonderful misapprehension and demanded that Clapp publish a retraction. President Clapp tartly retorted, "I hope for the future your time will be better employed." Edwards' running controversy with Charles Chauncey of First Church in Boston was one he rather enjoyed, because he respected Chauncey's intelligence. Chauncey was revolted by the awakening and said so in a massive, dignified book that Edwards had to admire, even though he disagreed with it. When Chauncey prodded the faculty of Harvard to issue a statement deploring Whitfield's methods, Edwards wrote him of his regret that the issue divided us into two armies, separated and drawn up in battle array, ready to fight with one another, which greatly hinders the work of God. By now, Sarah had learned the costliness as well as the magnificence of being married to an unusual man. Because her husband was totally committed to what appeared to him to be the will of God, he was not cramped by the tiny fears that make another kind of man cautious. Such a man is likely to collide with others who hold differing views of the truth. Fortunately, Sarah had now worked past her earlier need to be approved by everyone. The consistent serenity she had achieved after her crises made it possible for her to go on lovingly supporting Edwards and giving her children confidence that they were safe at home, however chilly the community was toward them. One afternoon, Edwards and Sarah were riding horseback together, enjoying the chance to be alone with each other, away from family noises. They had a favorite sandy road that skirted a low bluff on the river bank. There they stopped, and as they watched sheep munching the grass on cleared patches of pasture across the river, Edwards confided to Sarah his growing conviction that no one should join the church unless he made a profession of godliness. This was an explosive subject. The halfway covenant was a compromise worked out by the Synod of New England from 1657 to 1662. This device allowed the unawakened to enjoy part membership so their children could take part in congregational and, even more important, political activities. In colonial society, only church members had a vote in the town meetings that were held in April and September to choose the select men and tithing men, the sealers of leather, the overseers of weights and measures, the tax collectors, the men who put the town brand on all horses in case they strayed. Town meeting also chose the highway supervisors, who saw that each man put in 2 days a year helping work on the roads. In small communities where people had been closely bound together for common safety, they cared greatly about having power to influence such decisions. A man took his vote very seriously, and when his church membership was questioned, it was a major threat to him. In the turn of the century, Solomon Stoddard had diluted this compromise even more by proposing that the unregenerate could take communion, provided their refutations were not scandalous. Stoddard wanted to make room for those who weren't ready to claim that they had had an experience of regenerating grace. Increase Mather, Harvard's president, had been horrified. The debate between Stoddard and Mather had made a great noise in the country. Many people would reminisce about that controversy if Edwards were to go ahead in his proposal to restore the sanctity of the Lord's Supper, a transaction that he regarded with utmost awe. Sarah reported that Edwards told me that he would not dare ever to admit another person without a profession of real saving religion, and spake much of the great difficulties that he expected would come upon him by reason of his opinion. Edwards then drew up 4 simple statements a person might make in order to share in the Lord's Supper. All the statements were innocuous. This is one sample. I hope I do truly find a heart to give up myself wholly to God according to the tenor of that covenant of grace which was sealed in my baptism, and to walk in a way of that obedience to all the commandments of God as long as I live. The other 3 statements were equally temperate, but Sarah knew that the people would gag at saying even those mild words. Sarah was most apprehensive about the reaction of their cousin, friend, and protector, Colonel John Stoddard. Sometimes he talked of the probability of Colonel Stoddard's disliking my opposing the opinion and practice of his father. It is interesting that she said my, not his. Perhaps it was a slip of her pen, or it may be that Sarah knew that Stoddard had a particular esteem for her even more than for Edwards. Though she quaked, Sarah realized that she had chosen to marry the sort of man who did not give in when he believed a matter of deep principle was at stake. I asked him what course he intended to take. He said he knew not what. I asked him if he would not publish something expressly handling the subject and vindicating his opinion. He replied, not unless he was forced to it, for he did not at all love openly to oppose his grandfather in that manner. He said to preach against him would be looked upon as a great degree of arrogance, and much more to print against him. He chose for the present to content himself with giving some occasional intimations of his opinion that people may be thinking of it. They rode back to town together, and like an armada stocking up with water and dried meat for a long campaign, they began to store up strength. They knew what might happen when people realized what Edwards thought. as Sarah said. He often signified that when he should begin to have occasion to act on his principles, then the tumult would begin. There is an amusing aspect to what happened next. They waited tensely for a hullabaloo when Edwards' book on religious affections came out. Nothing happened at all. Sarah reports that he said to me that he wondered that he had heard nothing of the people's taking notice that he differed from Mr. Stoddard. The truth was that the people had not read the book. Edwards, who was nourished by literature, overestimated the impact of print on other people. There was no commotion because his parishioners either didn't read the book or, if they tried to look at it, didn't understand it. Edwards had made an error many intellectuals make. They project onto others a capacity for reflectiveness that many people do not have. A situation that would leave a finely turned personality thrumming may leave a less imaginative person merely indifferent. George Whitefield once commented on this when he told of seeing some criminals riding in a cart on their way to the gallows. They were tossing up who should sit on the right hand of the cart, with no more concern than children who are on their way to buy ice cream. Sarah continued her narrative. I had no imagination that he desired it should be kept a secret, and therefore both I and my children often freely spoke of it when we had occasion. She went on to tell how a friend had come up to visit them from New Jersey, bringing reports of the founding of a new college there. When Mr. Edwards told the visitors about the dilemma he faced, he predicted it was likely to be a means of throwing him out of business and bringing him and his family to poverty. The guests advised, "You had better run away from these difficulties and accept the place of the president of New Jersey College." But Sarah concluded, Mr. Edwards replied, "He must not run away." Chapter 10. Time out for two more romances. The most agreeable family I was ever acquainted with, Joseph Emerson. I am in one continued, perpetual, and uninterrupted hurry. David Brainerd. Before the Edwards drama crested, their children provided two subsidiary plots. One was humorous, though it did not seem so to the young man involved. The Reverend Joseph Emerson of Pepperell, Massachusetts, was dented by the charms of Esther Edwards and has left an ingratiating diary about his tribulations. Of all the girls, Esther was most like her mother and stamped with Sarah's social skills. She was a luminous beauty, but more. Her conversation was more entertaining than the bland chatter of most girls of the era. She was adroit at drawing out the shy and parrying wits with the intellectual, and she had an ebullient sense of humor. She dazzled young Mr. Emerson, and his story gives a revealing glimpse into the Edwards family scene. Emerson came of a respected family on the eastern coast, his father a man of substantial resources as well as one of superior scholarship, had come to Ipswich, Massachusetts in 1636 and married into a family named Waldo. An eventual product of this alliance was to be Ralph Waldo Emerson. Joseph Emerson, born in 1724, went to Yale, and he was returning from the Yale commencement in 1747 when, on the well-traveled road near Wethersfield, Connecticut, he and his friend Edwards Eales encountered Jonathan Edwards, also cantering back from the festivities in New Haven. Emerson's mother was related to the Samuel Moody, who had figured in the amusing incident the time Edwards was late for the speaking engagement at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, so Edwards was delighted to meet the young man. Confident that Sarah could improvise for unexpected guests, Edwards expansively invited both young men to detour over to Northampton for a visit before they started east to their homes. After his introduction to Northampton, Emerson wrote in his diary, "Spent the day very pleasant. The most agreeable family I was ever acquainted with. Much of the presence of God here." The household had to tuck in another unexpected guest while Emerson was there, a Mr. Spencer, who was ordained in Boston to be a missionary to the Indians at Albany. When the young men were ready to return home, Edwards escorted Emerson and his friend Eels across the river, leaving Emerson convinced that he is certainly a great man. Back home in Pepperell, our hero could not settle down to work. Studied some in the morning. I had determined to spend the rest of the day in fasting and prayer, but was interrupted. The reason for the prayer and fasting emerges as Emerson confides, "Monday, 7, set out some time before day on a journey to Northampton to visit Mrs. Esther Edwards to treat of marriage." In that time, women of high social rank were all addressed as Mrs. Though Esther was only in her mid-teens, girls married young then, and her charms seemed to have been in full bloom. Emerson writes, "Wednesday, 9, I got safe to Northampton, obtained liberty of the house. Thursday, 10, I spent chief of the day with Mrs. Esther, in whose company, the more I am, the greater value I have for her." Esther may have been embarrassed by her smitten house guest, for she managed to have an errand the next day, while Emerson occupied himself by copying off some things Edwards had lately received from Scotland. He cornered Esther for the evening, however, and the next day, Saturday, he spent a part of the day upon the business I came about. Sunday, a Mr. Eaton of Leicester also turned up, and Sarah kept Esther busy helping entertain the guests. Then church on Sunday intervened. Finally, Emerson had a chance on Monday to propose, but he could not obtain from the young lady the least encouragement to come again. Trying to talk himself into a cheery attitude toward his reverse, he added, "I hope the disappointment will be sanctified to me, and that the Lord will, by his providence, order it so this shall be my companion for life." Dolefully he rode off home. "I was considerable melancholy, concluded notwithstanding to make another trial in the spring. The church in Pepperell did not get its money's worth out of its young minister in the weeks after that. Saturday, 19. So discomposed I could not study. I could not have thought what I have lately met with would have had this effect. Friday, 23. I was this day so pressed down. I could not fix my mind to do anything at all. Saturday, 24. It seems to be growing upon me. I read a little, but chief of the day sat meditating on my troubles." Interspersed among these entries are notations about sick calls, committee meetings, the funeral of a child, preaching in a private house, visiting widows. Emerson plugged along at the rigmarole of keeping a parish going, but a note of loneliness is streaked through all his journal. Esther seems to have been so flabbergasted by this persistent swain that she turned to her mother to extricate her. Mr. Emerson received a letter from Mrs. Sarah Edwards of Northampton, who entirely discouraged me from taking a journey there again. I am disappointed. The Lord teach me to be resigned. He took a while to recover. He had a wedding, went doggedly to committee meetings, tried to take his mind off his disappointment. He wrote, Tuesday 21, very much out of order. I have a constant faintness at my stomach. By Sunday, the 2nd, he confesses in a line that would make any other minister know he had been through a trauma. I was obliged to preach old sermons all day. The following Sunday, he was still in pain. Preached on, there is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. My weakness still continues. And there Mr. Emerson, with queasy stomach and dashed hopes, departs from our narrative. 200 years later, we can feel for him in his rejection. However, he went on to marry an Abigail Hay and have a son who influenced the founding of Mount Holyoke College. The younger Joseph Emerson taught for 21 years in a normal school in Newburyport, a place where young women were prepared for teaching careers. One of his students was a bouncy little bird of a girl named Mary Lyon. The official biography of her, produced by Mount Holyoke, the college she was to found, says, Mr. Emerson revealed her to herself. While the church life in coastal Massachusetts was feeling the reverberations of Esther Edwards's magnetism, another daughter's romance was adding a touching footnote to the Edwards Chronicle. Jerusha was, according to her father's description, a very pleasant and useful member of this household, and that was generally esteemed the flower of the family. Sweet, generous, impulsive Jerusha was overwhelmed by a young visitor Edwards brought into the house on Thursday, May 28, 1746, unaware that he was bringing tragedy into it. The guest was David Brainerd, a young zealot who is still being debated. He is a figure almost as controversial as Edwards himself. Some consider him an authentic candidate for saintliness. Others spot neurotic extremes in his personality. There is no doubt that his short life profoundly affected the world missionary enterprise. By the time David Brainerd rode up to the gate on King Street on that May evening, he was already, at age 28, almost a character from folk lore. Brainerd had been born in Haddam, Connecticut, of a substantial family, whose house, standing back from the river, overlooked a fine view of groves and fields. His father, an official representative of the king in the provincial government, died when Brainerd was 9. His mother died when he was 14. These double deaths may have had much to do with the quirks of character Brainerd was to develop, though they left him well off financially, so that he was able to send other young men to college with his surplus inheritance. The loss of both parents was a psychic shock. Exceedingly distressed and melancholy, Brainerd worked on a farm until he was 20, making his home with the Haddam pastor, who gave him the dubious advice to stay away from youth and cultivate grave, elderly people. Brainerd later acknowledged that this priggish admonition led him to proceed at length on a self-righteous foundation. He went off to Yale in 1738, but a severe case of measles sent him home to Haddam in 1739. During this period, he was in a crisis of health and morale. much like Edwards' own slump in college. This may have been one reason why Edwards felt drawn toward the younger man. Brainerd, reminiscing about this unattractive period in his life, admitted that he had contested with the Almighty, finding fault with his ways of dealing with mankind. The awakening stirred him to a kind of religion so fervent that it led to his being expelled from Yale. The emotional ardor of the Whitfield Tenet brand of religion led Brainerd to form a cell group for devotions with a number of friends. One night, Brainerd remarked of a certain Yale tutor named Whittlesley that the man has no more grace than this chair. A noisy freshman lurking outside in the hall heard that impudent comment and raced off to report Brainerd. The rector of the college demanded a public apology. Brainerd retorted that he would not retract in public what he had said in a private conversation. He was expelled and became a topic of hot discussion throughout New England. In 1742, Brainerd sneaked back into New Haven for the commencement of his class. He probably stayed at James Pierpont's house. Someone, most likely Edwards himself, has tampered with Brainerd's diary, and a name has been erased, so one line reads, "Lodged at blank." The anonymous censor may have known that Pierpont was already in trouble for his hospitality to Whitfield and did not want it known that the controversial Brainerd had also been his guest. Brainerd had a talent for flamboyance. He decided to be an evangelist to the Indians in the hideous, howling wilderness west of the coastal colonies. At that time, the American colonial churches were not alert about missions. 100 years earlier, in 1646, the admirable minister of Roxbury, Massachusetts, John Eliot, had pressed back into the surrounding forest and learned to preach to the Indians in their own language. This impressed them so much that Eliot was able to organize more than a dozen communities of praying Indians. The enterprise had languished after Eliot's death. Only a few British philanthropical societies were still supporting missions to the American Indians, and these were in settled towns, not itinerant ministries. Brainerd persuaded a Scottish group called the Honorable Society for Propagating Christian Knowledge to sponsor him, and he plunged off the known maps. Soon the lonely young horseman had become a legend among New England and New Jersey churches. With no precedent to direct him, Brainerd simply started out to hunt some Indians to convert. He headed for Indian camps, reported to be at the forks of the Delaware River. But he picked up some advance gossip that those tribes were scrapping with the white settlers who had pushed in there. So Brainerd concluded that this was not the optimal time to talk in that place about the superiority of the white man's religion. Instead, he plunged into the woods between Stockbridge and Albany. Promptly lost, he spent all night in the open air, and on Good Friday of 1743, he confessed to his diary, "My heart was sunk. I seemed to have no God to go to." Fortunately, he next came across an ingenious young Indian named John Wawapiquant, who happened to know English because he had been raised by a white minister in Long Meadow, Massachusetts. With John as his guide, Brainerd crunched through the brush to an Indian colony deep in the forest where he stayed 7 weeks. Woods then were trackless, except for rare moccasin trails. When it rained, a rider had no raincoat to protect him. The natural oil in a wool cape was his only water repellent. Brainerd lived on what he could hunt or fish for, and his loneliness was colossal. One night he wrote in his journal of meeting with some Indians on an island in the Susquehanna River. He had encountered those same Indians the spring before, and they had seemed friendly, so Brainerd thought he was encouraged to come see them again. When he returned in September, however, the Indians ignored him. Nearly 100 braves were dancing around a fire, burning deer fat to make the flames spurt to a prodigious height. They danced and yelled so loud they might easily have been heard 2 miles or more, and paid no attention at all to their white visitor. Brainerd morosely watched them, and finally crept into a little crib made for corn, and there slept. The next day the Indians spent 3 more hours doing hideous charms and incantations, giving their visitor no opportunity to preach. He admitted it was the most burdensome and disagreeable Sabbath that ever I saw. One cannot imagine a situation in which a sensitive young man would feel more of an outsider. He wandered on to another encampment and again reached them on a Sunday. There appeared to be no Sabbath. The children were all at play. I was a stranger in the wilderness and knew not where to go. He encountered one crazed Indian who considered himself a restorer of what he supposed to be the ancient religion of the Indians. This man loomed before Brainerd, wearing a bearskin coat and bearskin stockings. He was shaking a dry tortoise shell with corn inside it to make it rattle, and wore a great wooden face, painted half black, half tawny. Our young reporter admits, "I could not but shrink away from it, although it was then noonday, and I knew who it was." That Brainerd came out alive from his wanderings in the forests was in itself an achievement. Medicine men were still powerful then. Brainerd observed many places where the ground was beat hard as a rock from dancing. These influential Indians did not welcome an outsider who threatened their power over their superstitious constituents. Also, the physical hardships of travel were great. Brainerd once rode to Stockbridge in December to attend an installation and wrote that he was very much fatigued with my journey, wherein I underwent great hardship, was much exposed and very wet by falling into a river. After another day of clambering over frozen trails, he admits, spent the evening in perplexity, a kind of guilty indolence. By November 1745, he had ridden more than 3,000 miles since March last and had baptized 23 Indian adults, 24 children. Word about Brainerd's adventures spread about the colonies, and he was invited to speak about them. He even went as far as East Hampton on Long Island, which was, in Edwards's words, the fairest, pleasantest town on the whole island, and one of its largest and most wealthy parishes.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3000, 3730 by fax at 780-468-1096 or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.